Let's turn to Judges, shall we? Chapter 14. That's where we left off. The life of Samson. Samson, and we've only begun to get into his character in chapter 13 and 14 of Judges, shows us that you can have a great beginning. But having a great beginning does not guarantee a great ending. He begins well. In fact, we might say, what more could God have done than what He already has done for this guy? The supernatural angelic announcement of his birth, godly heritage in his parents, a Nazarite vow was conferred upon him from birth. The power of the Holy Spirit came upon him in incredible ways, and yet he ends so poorly. He's not the only one. There are a few in Scripture that are like him. The Scripture warns us that we should take heed lest we fall. Whoever thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. And Samson is a good one to study in that regard. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once said, "Great is the art of beginning, greater is the art of ending." Ending well. I draw your attention back to a couple verses just to frame tonight's study, because we sort of broke off right in the middle of Samson's wedding. And we just want to garner a little bit of the background. If you'll notice in chapter 13, verse 1, it's that same phrase that is repeated that frames the setting for the whole book of Judges and once again for Samson. Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and so God delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. That's the setting. And because of that setting, we have the entrance now of Samson. Manoah was his dad. And Mrs. Manoah was his mom. We don't know her name, so we'll call her Mrs. Manoah. They didn't have children. She was barren. And that's a stigma in ancient Israel. And so one day, out of nowhere, the angel of the Lord appeared to Mrs. Manoah and said that she was going to have a child. And that he was to take the vow of a Nazarite. Natsar in Hebrew means to dedicate, and so from birth he was to be dedicated to God. There were some stipulations for the Nazarite. Number one, no wine, no contact with the fruit of the vine. Wine symbolized earthly joy. The point being, my joy is totally in the Lord. I will get off on the Lord only rather than in earthly delights. It was the same restrictions that the priests had who ministered before the Lord in the tabernacle. No wine, no wine products, no fruit of the vine. Second, the Nazarite grew his hair long. He didn't cut his beard, didn't cut his hair. And it is thought that that was a sign of shame, of humiliation, that a person would say, I'm willing to bear shame for the Lord. Even Paul in Corinthians says, does not even nature itself teach us that it's a shame for a man to have long hair? And so the Nazarite would bear the shame spiritually for the Lord. Third, no contact with a corpse. Touching a dead body, as most of you know, defiles a person ceremonially, requiring a lot of cleansing. And so, no contact at all with a dead person. Now, that was quite a price to pay, especially for a lifelong Nazarite. It would mean that you couldn't attend a funeral, even if it was your parents. That was a stiff penalty to pay, or a stiff regulation to follow. It meant that God is more important than anyone in my life, mother, father, sister, brother, son or daughter. Remember, even Jesus said, whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And I don't want to press the analogy too far, but I think many people will place relationships before God. They place their children before God. They place the family before God. And God wants us to honor our families, honor our mother and father. But we're to honor Him above everyone, because sometimes there will be a compromise Or at least the compromise comes as a temptation to sort of put aside our values and our spirituality for family peace. And Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace on earth, but a sword. And from this point on, a child will be divided from parents. You know the verse. So the Nazarite was saying, I'm singularly dedicated, devoted to God. No fruit of the vine, no touching of the corpse. I'm just dedicated to God above all else. Well, that is what he was to be brought up with. But if you look in chapter 14, verse 1, we get a hint of some of the problem. And we sort of left off in the middle of this chapter. It says he saw a woman. That's his big problem, women. And men can relate to that. Many who are listening right now can look at this guy and say, I relate to this guy. Don't want to admit it, but I can relate to him. He saw a woman in Timnah of the daughter of the Philistines. Now, he tells his father in the next few verses, I've seen a woman. She's gorgeous. Get her for me. He commands his dad, get her for me that she might be my wife. He thought he loved her. Actually, it was lust at first sight. He never met her, the text would indicate. He just saw her and places the physical above everything else. No conversation comes out of this. Later on, he'll meet with her, but he just says, I want this gal. She's good looking. And so he places looks above everything else and demands that the dad bring the girl. Well, as the story unfolds, a marriage contract is settled. A wedding feast takes place, which is a 7-day feast that includes lots of alcoholic beverages. In the Hebrew, it was really a drunken party. At the end of the 7 days, they would consummate the marriage. Well, on the way to this feast, Samson sees a lion that he had killed on a previous visit. He tore the lion apart, the carcass is in the road, and there was some honey because bees had formed a hive in the carcass of the honey. He reaches in, grabs the honey, and eats it. Then he goes to the feast, and there are 30 Philistine groomsmen who are part of the wedding party. Now, this is a problem, I think, I mentioned last time, because usually the groom supplies his own groomsmen. They're called friends of the bridegroom in the Jewish wedding. He doesn't bring anybody. He has no accountability in his own group. And so they provide friends, groomsmen for him. Now we pick it up in verse 12 of chapter 14. Samson said to them, this is after he had the honey. They're having this big party, you know, chugging down the Budweisers. Samson said to them, let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. And they said, pose your riddle that we may hear it. And so he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. Samson, and I'll sort of introduce this thought, and I think you'll see it in the rest of his biography. Samson is a kind of a guy who plays with fire. He wants to see how close he can get. And I think he's bragging, just like, you know, he came back, he destroyed the lion, and he's sort of puffed up with pride. He's shooting off his mouth. And it's going to get him into trouble. It came to pass on the 7th day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Great friends, huh? Imagine hearing that at your wedding. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so? Then Samson's wife wept on him and said, you only hate me. You do not love me. You have posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me. And he said to her, look, I haven't explained it to my father or my mother. Why should I explain it to you? You can tell it's not a great relationship. They're not off to a good start. Now, she had wept on him 7 days while their feast lasted. Now, just picture that. This is their wedding feast. It's supposed to be a time of celebration. So he poses a riddle, shoots off his mouth. They threaten her. She weeps. And the idea in Hebrew is she nagged him for 7 days. Just pestered him. It's his wedding. It's like, oh no, here she comes again. She's going to bring this thing up again. It happened on the seventh day that he told her because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. Interesting. Samson could kill lions. Very strong individual. But he had no power over a woman's tears. Actually, her manipulation. She was manipulating him. He lusted after her. He goes after her. Now she is his wife. And she presses him and he gives in, and it's going to cost him. I was reading a story about whales. It was an interesting story that up to 300 whales were beached. And the scientists were trying to figure out why these animals were caught, these whales were caught. And the scientists conjectured that these 300 whales had been chasing sardines. And they chased them into shallow water. And then the tide went out, which trapped them in shallow water. Eventually, they were beached. That's what happens to Samson. He's pursuing the sardine of his own pleasure, the lust of a woman. Eventually, he will be beached, destroyed by the pursuit of his own passion. As the story ends in chapter 16, that's what happens to this man. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, here they're going to solve the riddle, what is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? And then he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. Hardly a compliment to a new wife. You know, a heifer is a young cow that hasn't had a baby yet. And a heifer was a proverb for somebody very stubborn and cantankerous. And so he says of his wife, you know, right off the bat, this is not a good relationship. You've been plowing with my heifer, man, she told you. Then the Spirit of the Lord, and this is the uniqueness about Samson. Charles Spurgeon said his whole life is a series of miracles and follies. What a mixture. The miraculous, the foolish, wrapped up in one individual. We see that he becomes single-handedly the army of Israel. Nobody fights with him. He does it single-handedly, destroying the Philistines. The Spirit of the Lord came on him mightily. He went down to Ashkelon. This is 23 miles away from where this is taking place. And he killed 30 of their men and took their apparel and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused and he went back to his father's house. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, but he used that power in the wrong way, to avenge himself. This was not righteous retribution. This was not righteous indignation. This was personal vengeance. Okay, you want 30 changes of garments? Deal's a deal. Kills 30 Philistines, brings back the clothes. Here you go. And Samson's wife was given to his companion, that's his best man, who had been his best man. Boy, so many resources this guy had. So many spiritual resources. The Spirit of God came upon him mightily. And yet he squandered them. This isn't the first time. This isn't the only time. This will be a habit, a series with this guy. Many a Christian leader, many a Christian, has fallen into the same trap of this guy, Samson. Chasing after the sardines, getting beached in the end, put on the shelf. Paul called it in Corinthians, being put on the shelf so that that person is no longer useful to the Lord because of the character. Peter said, his divine power has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by glory and virtue. Every spiritual resource is ours, all that we need to be used by God, to be powerful vessels, God has invested for us, to work in us and through us. But we can squander those resources. And because we are God's children, when we start moving under the Spirit of God and God starts to use us, that's when you're a target. And don't think that Satan will leave you alone. I'm not saying this to scare you. I think by now you know this is true. Once you say, God, I surrender all. My life is yours. Use me. Do you think hell's going to stand by idly and go, yay, three cheers for him? No. Satan and his minions have studied you. They know your weaknesses. They know your strengths. That is why to be used by God means to withstand attack. How do you do that? More rules, more regulations? I read another story about a submarine, a nuclear submarine called the Thresher. The Thresher was in the North Pole area. It was actually sailing under the Arctic ice toward the North Pole at a very low depth. It got a little bit too low and the hull imploded. Too much pressure. It was designed for depth, but it got too low, and even this thick iron skin of the submarine imploded and destroyed it. Now, what is interesting is there are some species of fish that can go as low as the nuclear Thresher submarine and lower. They're very thin-skinned. They don't implode. Why? Because there is a pressure that is equal and opposite on the inside of the fish so that the pressure on the outside doesn't crush it. That's the secret. In life, as we face temptation, there's that pressure to conform to the world, pressure to give in to the assails of the devil. You can put walls high of rules and regulations. They will not help. What you need is the equal and opposite pressure of the Spirit of God inside of you. God's power working in you. And you'll withstand the pressure. He needed to tap into that. Unfortunately, he gave way to his flesh. Chapter 15. After a while, in the time of the wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. Isn't that romantic? It doesn't sound romantic to us. Women, you'd like perfume, flowers, diamonds. But back then, a goat was the equivalent in that culture. Now, Samson didn't know that the best man has his wife. He never got to consummate the marriage. Dad gave her to the best man to consummate the marriage. You know, now he feels good. He's killed 30 Philistines. He's back on track. So he's going to go visit his wife. By the way, that is a form of marriage. It's still prevalent among Palestinian Arabs called the Sadiqah marriage, whereby the marriage vows are exchanged, but the woman lives with her family, with her parents. And the guy goes gallivanting around and comes back and visits her from time to time, and it's customary to bring a gift. He said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room," but her father would not permit him to go in. He finds out that father-in-law, good jovial guy that he is, gave his wife to the best man, which will set him off to no end. Not only does this guy have a problem with lust, he has a problem with anger, uncontrolled. After all, he's strong. Physically, he can do great feats. He's using the power the Holy Spirit has given him to gratify his flesh. It's a pattern we see through his life. By the way, this is not the first time a bridegroom is surprised in the Scripture. Adam was one of those bridegrooms that was surprised, right? He went to sleep single, and he woke up married. Happily married. But went to sleep, boom, wow. The Lord brought the woman to the man. Then there was Jacob. He was surprised. He went to sleep what he thought was Rachel, and he woke up with Leah. Because, again, the father did a switcheroony. And he had to work another 7 years to get the wife of his dreams. Then there was Boaz. He was surprised. He woke up in the middle of the night and there was his wife-to-be at his feet. And the marriage contract was arranged. Let's look at verse 2. Her father said, "Well, I really thought that you thoroughly hated her. Therefore," and by the way he talked about her, you could understand that. Hey, this is my cow, heifer. So he thought, you know, I watched you guys. I thought you hated her. So I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? What kind of a dad is this? Please take her instead. And Samson said to them, this time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them. Then Samson went and caught 300 foxes. Better word would be jackals. The Hebrew word could refer to either or. And we think it's a jackal because foxes are more solitary creatures. Jackals run they have a herding instinct. They run in groups. And so probably since they were prevalent in the area, it was a jackal. Does it matter? I don't think so, but I thought I'd share it with you. And he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. When he had set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and the olive groves. You get the picture. He takes a couple of these creatures, ties their tails together, puts a firebrand in between them, and lets them go. Now, the instinct naturally, if you were to capture a jackal and let it go, it would hightail it to the den. It would find its den and go home. But tying two of them together, putting a fire torch between their tails, would disorient them sufficiently to panic. They can't maneuver well because they're tied to each other, so they would scramble through the fields. And the torch would set the grain. So the grain is affected. The olive crop is affected. So that's their oil for burning lamps, etc. And their vineyards. So their wine, their fuel, and their bread. And these are agricultural people. The Philistines came from the Aegean area, went down to Egypt, were defeated by the Egyptians, settled in Israel. And they grew crops in the fertile southern Judean valleys. Now, Samson, through his trickery, destroyed their crops. He has a philosophy that is, it's an interesting one, and actually it's a prevalent one. Do unto others just as they did to me, only worse. That's his philosophy. You took out a tooth, I'll get the whole set of uppers. I'll knock you down so hard that you'll never want to get up again. Do unto others as they do unto you, only worse. That's his philosophy. That's how he started out. Okay, I'm blameless if I go after the Philistines this time. It's your fault, not mine. He's blaming others for it. He goes after them. It is our natural tendency to strike back. Revenge is natural. Forgiveness is supernatural. Jesus said, if somebody strikes you on one cheek, you turn the other cheek. That's supernatural. And you know it's difficult to do. It takes an act of willing obedience. If you go by feeling, you'll never do it. Revenge feels good. There was a truck driver in Broken Bow, Nebraska, pulled his rig into a truck stop, sat down for breakfast. And was enjoying it. It was a quiet early morning, 6:30 in the morning. Eggs, bacon, coffee. Three Hells Angels pull up, motorcycles parked outside. They get off their Harleys and they swagger into the restaurant looking for trouble. And they find this guy eating his breakfast. They go, let's get him. So the three Hells Angels go over to the guy and one of the bikers takes the eggs on the plate and smears it all over the truck driver's chest. Another Hells Angels grabs the bacon and eats it. Another one takes coffee and pours it all over his head and all over his lap. And they're trying to pick a fight. The truck driver looks up, says nothing, he's outnumbered, pays the bill, walks outside, gets in his truck and leaves. The Hell's Angels, they're bewildered. They were looking for a fight. They didn't get any. And they're scratching their head and one says, man, he wasn't much of a man. And the waitress looking out the window says, you know, and he wasn't much of a truck driver either because he just ran over three motorcycles. Now we hear that and we go, yeah, I like that. That feels good. It feels good to hear it even. That's natural. It's supernatural to forgive. Samson was indeed a natural man. The Philistine said, verse 6, "Who has done this?" And they answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Isn't that what they threatened to do if she didn't tell what the riddle was, right? Ironic, isn't it? She used deception to save herself, and in the end, she destroyed her own household after it was all said and done. Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this," like he's blameless, "I will surely take revenge on you, and after that I will cease." Actually, he won't. Anger and revenge, once you get on, it's like a treadmill. It's hard to get off. Once you get on it, it's one thing after another. In the ancient Semitic cultures, there is sort of a custom called the Avenger of Blood custom. If somebody is killed in your family, you find out who killed them, and you go back and you take one of, it's the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, the lex talionis, the law of retribution. So he says, "Okay, I've had it. You made me really mad. It's your fault, okay, but I'm gonna do some damage, and after that, it'll be all right. I'll feel better. I'll cease." So he attacked them hip and thigh, an idiom for with a great, great, hefty attack. With a great slaughter, and he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Etam. Now the Philistines went up, encamped in Judah, and deployed themselves against Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" So they answered, "We have come up to arrest Samson, to do to him as he has done to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam. Notice the thousands of people that go out against one man. You know, they want to be sure. This guy's dangerous. So 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock, and they said to Samson, "Do you know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." See, there's his philosophy. Do unto others as they have done unto you, only worse. But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines." Then Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." I find it fascinating that here's a guy, okay, he's selfish, yes, and he's sinful, yes, and he made mistakes for his own flesh, yes. At the same time, God is using this sinful character to deliver the children of Israel out of the hand of the Philistines, but the children of Israel have acquiesced. They've sort of given up. They have accepted the status quo. They've accepted the Philistine domination over them. Hey, they rule over us, man. You know, don't upset them. I find that same kind of compromise around a lot of God's people. Hey, that's the value system of this world, man. We might as well fit in. You don't want to stand out. You don't want to create any kind of wave. You don't want to be that different. You just sort of want to fit in so they accept us and like us. That's the philosophy of this group of people. Jesus said, if the salt loses its flavor, it is good for nothing. It is good for nothing. And he said, you are the salt of the earth. Isn't it amazing that the Philistines did not see the children of Israel as a threat? That's pretty bad. We should be concerned if Satan ignores us. See, I'm never hassled by the enemy. That's not a good sign. That's a danger sign. If you're doing damage to the kingdom of darkness, you will be assailed. That's a good sign. The children of Israel posed no threat to the Philistines. They just said, we have no qualms with you. We just want to arrest Samson. So we brought 1,000 policemen to do it. They said, we have come down to arrest you, that we can deliver you into the hands of the Philistines. Verse 13, they spoke to him saying, no, we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you. And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. The children of Israel are doing the enemy's work. They are delivering their leader into his hands, saying, here, you take him. Again, I have watched God's children do Satan's work. You would expect that all of the attacks would come from the outside of the church. All the gossip, all the slander, all of the attacks on God's people, they come from the world. But no, we find that within the church, we have an amazing ability to self-destruct. To say to Satan, in effect, hey, you take a little Sabbath. Just give me the arrows. Let me shoot them. Doing the enemy's work for him. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting again. And you can imagine this. Here he is, bound by these ropes, walking into the camp of the Philistines, and a huge shout of victory goes up. Yes! He's delivered into our hands. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire. And his bonds broke loose from his hands. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. That's important, the fresh part, because a dried one would break. It still maintained its tenacity, its strength. Reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, now, you know, this guy is poetic. He kills a lion and he gets honey out of the carcass and he comes up with a riddle. He kills 1,000 Philistines and, you know, he waxes eloquent, writes a song. With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men. Now, in Hebrew, that would have rhymed. Donkey is hamor. With the jawbone of a hamor, donkey. Heaps upon heaps, homer. It's a play on words. So he composes a cute little tune. Also it was, and it, so it was, when he had finished speaking, that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called the name of that place Ramoth Lehi, or Jawbone Heights. What it means. Jawbone Hill. And then he became very thirsty, and so he cried out to the Lord, and he said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out, and he drank, and his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore, he called its name En Hakor, which means spring of the collar. Or maybe in his case, we should call it spring of the whiner. You know, he's an amazing guy. He waxes eloquent and then he's thirsty. Well, I'm going to die, God. You're going to die. You just killed 1,000 men. But I'm thirsty. I want to bring up a point here before we move on. And I think it happens more often than we think. After great victories, we're vulnerable. We're prone to certain things. After great victories, especially one that requires a lot of stamina, strength, physical, emotional, mental, we can be prone to depressive behavior. Now, some will deny that. Oh, no, Christians never get depressed. These are only Christians that have never read the Bible, I suppose. Because some of the greatest people in the Bible and out of the Bible who were men of God and women that were used of God sort of fell into the same thing. David, the great man of God, you've read his Psalms. In one single psalm, he'll be way up in heaven and then I'm just the worst there is. In one psalm, David said in one particular area, my soul is in anguish. How long, O Lord? How long? There had been an episode, a period of this disillusionment, this depression. Elijah, I think, sort of interfaces with this story quite well. Elijah defeated the prophets of the false prophets on Mount Carmel. You remember that? And then he runs down toward Horeb, down in the Sinai. And he, after this great victory, he crawls under a juniper tree and he goes, okay, God, kill me. I want to die now. He was suicidal after a great victory. Charles Spurgeon, I quote him many, many times. Great, great man of God. told his congregation that he suffered depression to the depths of which I hope none of you ever arrive. He said there are dungeons that are located underneath the castles of despair. That's how he put it. Alan Redpath, one of my favorite authors, back in 1964, suffered a stroke, a near-fatal stroke. He wrote, he admitted, he became so depressed he wanted to kill himself. Suicidal. Now here's this guy, great victory, 1,000 Philistines killed, and he goes, you know, you're just going to kill me here and deliver me into the hands of the Philistines. What makes it worse, I think, for the believer, and by the way, there's a great book called Spiritual Depression by Martin Lloyd-Jones that I think deals with some of these subjects beautifully. But what makes it worse for the believer is the added stigma of guilt. This idea that, well, I'm a Christian, I shouldn't feel this way. But I do. I'm supposed to have joy and victory, and I don't. And so it gets worse. It's more compounded. One person put it this way, for the Christian, feeling down can be more damaging than falling down because of that stigma. And then you have enough other Christians who are around them who don't understand it, and they just say, what's wrong with you? Where's your joy in the Lord, brother, sister? And that doesn't help, does it? So after a great victory, he's prone to this behavior, as was Elijah, as was David, as was Spurgeon, etc. And the chapter closes, and he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Now we come to the last chapter of his life. Chapter 16 is the sad, sad ending. He began as a Nazirite. The Spirit of God came upon him. His birth was announced by an angel, etc. But now we see him following his flesh to the point where his life is ended in remorse. Samson went to Gaza, and he saw a harlot there, and he went into her. Gaza's 40 miles from his hometown. It's a seacoast city. He sees a harlot. Obviously, he doesn't see the discrepancy between being a dedicated servant of God, a Nazirite, and sleeping with a harlot. When the Gazites were told Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were quiet all night, saying, in the morning when it's daylight, we'll kill him. So they went to sleep that night, closed the gates of the city, locked them tight, which didn't matter to him. He just plucked the gates up. Samson lay down, lay low until midnight. Then he arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Two possibilities. A, he took the gates and he went down to Hebron. That's sort of traditionally how it's looked at, 38, 40 miles away from there. And Gaza is about 100 feet above sea level. Hebron is 3,300 feet above sea level. So that's quite an ascent to go 40 miles with doors on your back. By the Spirit of God, he could do anything. God can do whatever he wants. But notice it says the top of the hill that faces Hebron. More likely the scenario is that one of the hills near Gaza, he took the doors up as the trophy. So they would come out in the morning, not see the gates. It's the hill that faces Hebron. And they would say, oh, man, who did this? Afterward, it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek. See this woman thing coming up again. It was a Timnite, then it was a harlot. Now it's a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. Have you ever met a girl named Delilah? You probably haven't. And that's because though the name is a beautiful name, it means delicate or dainty. No girl would want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. No parent on earth would say, I'm going to name her Delilah. Because of this story, this gal ruined the name for thousands of years. He loved, it says, a woman. Interesting wording. He loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. I think this gal was probably a knockout. He saw the Timnite, and after looking at her, said, oh, man, I love her. I don't think he understood what real love was. He sees another girl, and she was probably gorgeous. Satan works that way, you know. When he wants to get to you, he'll package up the temptation as nice as he can do it. He'll make it glittery and shiny and attractive. You go, wow, that's what I've wanted all my life. You recall the text in James where he said, each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires, and listen to this, and enticed. The word enticed means to bait a hook. Very suggestive meaning, to bait a hook. It's a word of the hunter or the fisherman, to lure the prey out from safety, to cover up the hook with a beautiful looking bait. So that you'll just see the bait, not what's underneath it, to entrap you. In South America, there is a phosphorescent spider that emits beams of radiation that is very attractive to the moth. The moth sees the little dazzling lights and he's attracted by it. And with every emission of that radiation, the moth gets closer and hovers closer until finally it's dead meat. The spider gets it. That's how temptation works. The bait is attractive, but what's underneath it? Case in point, David and Bathsheba. David saw a beautiful woman bathing. That was the bait. The hook was underneath it. He didn't see what the adultery would do. He didn't foresee the death of Uriah, the death of his son, the rape of his daughter. All that happened because that attractive bait. I should say that there's nothing wrong with being tempted. I know Christians that feel guilty because they're tempted. Hey, hello, you're a human being. Every human being is tempted. There's nothing sinful about being tempted. There's nothing sinful about that bait that comes to you that the enemy uses. The sin comes when it's grasped, when it's acted upon. All of us have natural desires. God placed them for our survival. We have the desire to eat, otherwise you'd starve. We have the desire to breathe. We have the desire to have sex, to keep. God put that in us for the sake of growth of His earth, of His creation. The desires that are God-given, however, must be God-governed. If the desires that we have as human beings, even as spiritual human beings, that are given by God are not governed by God, therein lies the danger. We'll just go for the bait and we'll not consider the hook underneath. When we are tempted, the way I see it, most temptations are the offer of a shortcut. We want fulfillment, right? Everybody wants to be happy. And so maybe you look at a girl and you think, oh, that's what I always wanted. That's what Samson thought. Oh, she's gorgeous. She's the one I wanted. The temptation part of it is where it's like the devil says, you want fulfillment, you can have it now. You can have this, just go for it. You don't have to wait on God. You don't have to go through premarital classes. You don't have to go through that nonsense. Just go for it. Grab it. But what promises fulfillment never fulfills. Now, he will trade his relationship with God for a moment of fulfillment, but in the end, he will be awfully sorry. The Lord of the Philistines, verse 5, came to her and said to her, entice him and find out where his great strength lies and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him and afflict him. They're very, very open about their intent. And every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So this is 5,500 pieces of silver, and money speaks, and it spoke to her. She may have had feelings for him, but they were quickly overcome by this bribe. So Delilah said to Samson, now listen to this. You got to think this guy's like an idiot or something, but just listen to how she comes on to him. Please tell me where your great strength lies and with what you may be bound to afflict you. I think that's very honest. Now, Samson is the kind of guy, you know, he wants to get as close as he can, right? He's just sort of walks the edge. To him, it's a big game. It's like Russian roulette. Of course, he's going to by the bullet in a minute. But you think, oh, nothing can get me. So to him, it's a big game. And she just sort of comes on to him. Oh, you big Hulk, you're so handsome and strong. Tell me the secret of your strength. So he's kind of puffed up by it. He said to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings, bowstrings being twisted gut or sinew from an animal, not yet dried, I shall become weak and be like any other man. So the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings, not yet dried, and she bound him with them. Now men were lying in wait, staying with her in the room, and she said to them, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he broke the bowstrings as a strand of yarn breaks when it touches fire. So the secret of his strength was not yet known. Then Delilah said to Samson, look, you have mocked me. Now, I think at this point I'd say, excuse me? I think you mocked me. I mean, you were the one that got me bound and then the Philistines came in. But she says, you've mocked me. You've told me lies. Now please tell me what you may be bound with. And so he says to her, well, if they bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used, then I shall become weak and become like any other man. Therefore Delilah took new ropes, bound him with them, and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. And the men were lying in wait, staying in the room. But he broke them off his arm like a thread. Delilah said to Samson, until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me what you may be bound with. And he said to her, if you weave the 7 locks of my head into the web of a loom. You know, Delilah whines, right? Each time. And now, with each game he's playing, he mentions his hair. Now, the secret of his strength was not his long hair, by the way. His secret was his dedication to God. The result, it was seen in the fact of the outward sign of the covenant, the hair that was not cut. But now he's mentioning that part of the covenant of God. And you wonder, you know, this happens once, then twice, and 3 times, and you think, this guy is like a cheesehead. He's like getting closer each time. You know, some Christians can sail so close to the lake of fire that their sails get singed. You know, they just want to see how close they can get and still be a Christian. And people will even ask, hey, can I still be a Christian if I do this? What kind of a question is that? That's not the way to approach life. Can I still make it to heaven by the hair of my chinny chin chin? And so he's walking right on the edge here with his temptation. He could see the trap, but he seemed to like it. It's like, this is fun. I'm being tempted, but it's kind of neat. When we become self-sufficient in temptation, we think, that's okay. I can handle it. You've fallen right there. He that thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. I can handle this chick, no problem. But it will be a problem. So she wove it tightly with the batten of the loom and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he awoke from his sleep and pulled out the batten and the web from the loom. And she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? Oh, please. You have mocked me these 3 times. And have not told me where your great strength lies. And it came to pass when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him so that his soul was vexed to death. That he told her all of his heart. Here is our problem. All of our problem. We have a new nature. That's not a problem until it comes in conflict with the old nature. But here's the problem. God has given us a new nature in Christ. We're in love with Him. We have a desire to serve Him and to walk with Him. And He's given us that implanted spiritual nature that is a hunger for the things of God, a will to do His will. The problem is there's still that part of me, that old nature, that remains even after salvation. That is in conflict. The flesh wars against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh so that you cannot do the things that you wish. And Paul talked about that conflict in Romans chapter 7. Things that I know that I should do, I don't. The things that I know I shouldn't do, I find myself doing. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from the body of this death? The enemy knows this about us. He has studied us. And just like Delilah is studying Samson to find out not only his strength but his weaknesses, our enemy, the devil, and his minions, as I mentioned, have studied you, and he knows your weaknesses. That is why when he attacks you, they're custom-made fiery darts, crafted just for your personality. Looks for the time when you're most vulnerable and shoots them. Relationships can be wonderful, they're powerful, they can be detrimental. Before I came to Jesus Christ, I had a girlfriend in California who, she was not a believer, I was not a believer. Her brother became a Christian, witnessed to everybody he could find. And my girlfriend and I had a mutual disdain for Christians. I was moving away from the area, going up to Northern California, and we made a vow to each other. Whatever happens this summer, we will not become a Christian. The pressure may be strong. You may find yourself in a moment of weakness, like you need to pray this prayer. Don't do it. We talked about it. Well, I was up in the San Jose area. I've told you the story many times. I gave my heart to Christ. Then I went back down to Southern California, and I was worried. What am I going to tell her? I knew the strength of a relationship. I knew that she could hinder me. I think she'd say, "Oh, you dummy. We made a promise, man. You broke your promise." But I found out that she had given her heart to Christ. And thank God she broke her promise. And God fulfilled his. But this relationship is that snare for Samson, hindering her. So he told her all of his heart and said, "No razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man." When Delilah saw that he had told her all of his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up once more, for he has told me all of his heart." So the lords of the Philistines came up, brought the money in their hand, and she lulled him to sleep on her knees. What a picture of temptation. Rocking the Christian to sleep. And called for a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. And she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." So he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Spirit or that the Lord had departed from him. That is one of the saddest verses in all of the Holy Writ. God had departed from him, and he didn't know it at first. Relying upon past experiences, "I can do this, I can do it." In his own strength, he couldn't do it. The covenant had been broken. The Nazarite vow, that sign that he had had from being a child, was broken. The Spirit of God had departed. I wonder how many people go to church every Sunday, Bible in hand, going through the motions. And they look like everybody else, but maybe we're unaware the Spirit of God has departed or never was there. Just that outward shell, that outward facade. The Philistines took him, put out his eyes, and brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. How humiliating. He's reduced to the level of an animal. They would tie the oxen to grind so often. The slaves would do it. The effect of sin is that it reduces you to the level of an animal. Seriously, it does. You say, "Well, how does it do it?" Because an animal lives to satisfy his own flesh. He lives by instinct. Animal wants to procreate. Animal goes out and procreates. Animal wants to eat. "I'm hungry." Just goes out and eats. If you live according to your own flesh, just doing whatever you feel you want to do, that's what animals do. You reduce yourself to the level of an animal. And that's the effect in his life. He's grinding grain in the enemy's temple. Samson traded God's power for personal pleasure. Samson traded a relationship he had with God for a relationship with Delilah. Samson traded a life of significance for a moment of pleasure. Now, if you were to interview Samson in that temple, now that he's blind completely, Samson, was it worth it? What would he say? Oh, don't you know that with every passing moment he was rehearsing his life, what he could have been, what he should have been, all of the mistakes he had made. The one whose name meant sunshine of the sun, Shimshon, Samson, is now living in utter darkness, unable to see, living like an animal. Well, we're out of time, so we can't finish the rest of the chapter, but we will next week. Let me close with another story. There was a story written by G.H. Charnley. It was called The Skylark's Bargain. And in it, there's a little young fledgling skylark who's just getting his wings, learning to fly, soar the air. But he finds an older man who strikes a bargain with the young skylark. Feathers for worms. You give me one of your feathers, young skylark, I'll give you two worms so you don't have to go do it for yourself. It's easy. You just come down here, worms, feathers. One day he's flying with his father, and his father says, you know, son, and they're flying along, God gave us these great wings that we can soar the air above the earth and enjoy his creation and not get bogged down with what's on the ground. We need our wings. But the young skylark could only see worms. There's a guy down there with free worms, man. All I have to do is give him a feather, I get two worms. So he flew down, gave him two feathers, got four worms, feast. Well, he kept doing this. So that by autumn, when it was time for them to get up and fly south in warmer climates, he had no strength in his wings left. He had no feathers to lift him above the earth and carry him. He squandered his future for worms. Like Samson squandered his future. Though God used him, it was in spite of him. The glory belongs to God. The Spirit of God did use this imperfect vessel, but what he could have become, but he traded it all in for a moment of pleasure. And then another moment, and then another moment, till finally the worms were gone and he couldn't fly. Choices are important. They must be made every single day.